Hello and welcome back to the Vacation Bible School podcast. We are taking a break from our regularly scheduled programming because it's Christmas time. We'll be back to finish up Exodus at some point in the future. I've been saying that for literally months. Hi, I'm Jason Kirk. On this program, we are going book by book, story by story, through the Bible, rediscovering the stories that raise us as youth, and learning a whole lot more about what is actually going on behind the scenes. We'll be joined shortly by my wife, Emily, our longtime co-host here, and a bunch of other guests. This is one of our Patreon Associate Pastor Fellowship episodes. We'll start it off. We'll run through the Bible version of the Christmas story. Then we'll chat about, you know, memories and traditions and compare denominations and all that stuff. And I have a few other books to do book reports on. But let's get right to it. So, let us try to make it through the gospel version of the story in, let's shoot for 10 minutes or less. Let's see if we can pull that off. We usually talk about the Gospels as if they're like one story repeated several times, which is kind of accurate. And that's how like I grew up with it. And I think, you know, most of us who grew up with the stuff and didn't go to seminary came up on it. You know, they're kind of different, but you never really think about or talk about why. And it's really interesting going back and reading it. They're like glaringly, obviously different, clearly written by different people for different reasons. And as you learn more, written at different times, with different effects. The Christmas story is Matthew and Luke. But first, I think it's important to talk a little bit about Mark, which does not contain the Christmas story, but published about 40 years after Jesus' death. It's considered the oldest published gospel that we know of. Opens with John the Baptist baptizing an adult man named Jesus. We're cutting right to the story. Mark is tension and urgency, hustling toward the cross. Mark is sprinting to reveal the answer of how a dead man can establish a kingdom where the last people in line get to become the first people in line. Mark 10:31. Old things are passing away. All things are about to become new. So Mark is an apocalypse story about a man who is here to save the world, who's being kind of secretive about it, and then it's revealed, yes, he was. He is the one all along. So Mark is a basic version of the Jesus story that caught fire all around the Mediterranean. The Roman Empire at the time had, you know, a million overlapping pantheons, Greek gods and Egyptian gods and so on and so forth. But now here's a story of a god who looks like a human, acts like a god, is a human, died like a human, came back like a god. His message is that we should treat humans like they are gods because God is coming back soon. You know, as far as we know, the basic version was a lot like Mark's, but there were endless other competing versions. I was watching The Mandalorian at the time, I was thinking about how, like, anytime there's a new episode of The Mandalorian, you know, there's endless speculation. What does this mean? Oh, this guy's back. What, is this guy going to be important, right? Like, everyone has their own interpretations and arguments and like, Boba Fett's back. That sucks. Or Boba Fett's back. Hooray! You know, finally he has lines. And that's how people have always been with stories, especially stories that seem to be important about the fate of the world. We want to argue about the rules, right? And the rules of this story were nowhere near as settled as theologians like to argue. At the time, you know, people are arguing, is Jesus fully God? Is Jesus fully man? Is he a righteous man inhabited by God during baptism? Which is kind of what is suggested by the Gospel of Mark. Was Jesus sent by a mystery all-father to defeat the storm god of Genesis? This is what the Gnostics would tell you. The Gnostics considered themselves completely Christian. Was death a sacrifice for sins, or was it less important than the message? Is the message mystical code or ethical advice, or... There's all these big arguments. And to answer these things, it would be helpful to know where this God-man came from. Mark doesn't care because he's in a hurry to tell us about the end of the world. Matthew, however, he comes along. Matthew, which is presented in the New Testament as the first gospel, it's not the oldest. It's based on Mark. He's quote-tweeting Mark and adding some of his own stuff. And Matthew's primary objective is clear. He wants to convince Jews that Jesus is the Messiah, and then he wants to work on the rest of the world. Matthew's Abraham genealogy presents Jesus as the culmination of the Hebrew Bible, and he's constantly referring back to old verses, callbacks. Matthew's a very big, like, reference, fan service guy. So we meet Joseph and his fiancée Mary, and Matthew does present it in that order. Matthew has an angel tell Joseph, hey, God made Mary pregnant, so you should marry her. Which, and this jumped out to you, is like not exactly how the story is remembered. Matthew 1:23, Mary's baby boy gets a name that means God is with us, and is not really used because it was just there to check a prophecy box. It refers back to Isaiah 7:14, as does Matthew's idea of Mary being a virgin. We will talk about that. King Herod hears from some traveling magi who are following a star about the special baby of prophecy. Herod's advisors quote the Hebrew book of Micah at him, concluding the baby must have been born in Bethlehem, ancient hometown of King David. Herod was the appointed Roman governor of the area at the time. The King David lineage is important because that's the one, you know, there's all sorts of ideas about what the Messiah could mean. It could mean a king, could mean a general, could mean a rebel leader, could mean the you know, an apocalyptic figure. There's tons of ideas, but Matthew's working with at least one of them. Jesus' family flees Herod to Egypt, a reference to Genesis. Abraham and Joseph fleeing to Egypt. And we're told this fulfills a prophecy from Hosea. Herod freaks out and kills all the baby boys, the two-year-olds and down, a reference to Moses. And we're told this fulfills Jeremiah. Herod dies, so it's safe for Jesus' family to return. Again, just like Moses. They settle in the backwater of Nazareth. And Matthew insists this is a prophecy too, but it reads more like he's looking for really intricate puns. Like it's... this one feels like a stretch to me. And that's it. That's the Christmas story in Matthew. So going from Mark to Matthew, we've given Jesus an origin story with 1,000 years of buildup. And these days, if someone is, you know, searching for a religion, like they want something with some historical backing to it, some ancient truth to it that feels more authentic. And the Romans are the same way. You tell them, hey, we have this cool new demigod, and they think, oh, okay, yeah. But then you tell them it's got backstory that is older than Aristotle and Plato and the Odyssey and the Iliad. And they say, okay, okay, we'll listen to that. But we can go bigger because the Gospel of Luke, probably written by a Greek, Roman physician, someone a little bit different worldview, also builds on stories like Mark's. Luke has, I would say, four big things going for it. First, he's actually a good writer. I like Mark. He's very blunt and curt, and he's like this apocalypse Hemingway, right? And Matthew is just constantly detouring to cram in more like, yeah, I've read the Bible. Yeah, and whereas Luke is like, I'm going to focus on having like characters act like people and people respond to each other and ask questions. And like when an insane thing happens where an angel is crashing through my ceiling, I'm going to have my characters say like, this is weird, right? Like Luke's people act like people. Second, Luke has a grander theology, not quite as grand as John's, where Jesus is walking around like, you know, announcing himself and doing magic shows, but a bigger, broader theology where Jesus on the cross in Mark is, God, why have you abandoned me? And is presented as like literally a question. Whereas Jesus on the cross in Luke is focused on saving the souls of the executioners and criminals around him. And it's possible, you know, all these things line up into one story, but they're specific story choices that tell us different things about what these authors are trying to show about Jesus. Third, Luke is the social justice warrior gospel. Luke's Jesus goes hard in defense of the disadvantaged, cannot stand rich people. the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, the rich man still being an asshole even in hell. These are all specifically Luke. It's also very much unlike Matthew, which pitted Gentiles against Jews. Luke has a Jewish holy man saying Jesus will be a light for Gentiles and a glory for Jews. Luke's Jesus is for everybody. And fourth, Luke has almost all of what we think of when we think of the Christmas story. So Luke one-ups Matthew's genealogy, taking it back not only to Abraham, because Matthew is preaching to Jews. Luke takes it back to God because Luke is preaching to everyone. Unlike Matthew, this is big, Luke frequently demonstrates women are important. The angel breaks the news to Mary herself. In Luke, Mary gets emotions, memories, friendships of her own. She questions God's plan and consents to it. That's important. In Luke, she writes a poem in Greek, which means Luke is showing her as really quite educated for a poor teenager. And this poem rules, the Magnificat. It's this beautiful poem about what God is doing here today, right now, in this moment, via Christmas, which is, I think the way it's presented in at least the churches I grew up in is like salvation and forgiveness. Well, this poem is about God is here to overthrow society. God is here to topple the rich, empower the poor. He's doing it via a humble girl. It's this like radical thing. And I'm going to drop it in the VBS Discord. Somebody did a really cool piece of art with Antifa Mary, where she's like stomping on the head of a snake and... y'all can see it if you're in there. But yeah, and I think even chapter one of Luke, you could argue it passes the Bechdel test. The rule that, you know, a movie should have two women talking to each other about something besides their boyfriends. Well, we have Mary is not alone because, you know, Mary and Matthew, she's got Joseph who's barking orders at her or whatever. Mary here, she has Elizabeth, who is John the Baptist's mother, right? So now not only does Mary have a mentor, John the Baptist has an origin story, and Jesus and JB are further connected. So Luke uses his space to expand on stories. So during a trip to Bethlehem, we'll talk about that, Jesus is born. There's no room at the inn. There's a baby in a manger, shepherds watching their flocks at night, angels appear, glory to God in the highest, Mary's heart is full, and that is Christmas. So let's talk about the things that were in either Matthew or Luke, not both. The Magi are in Matthew, because Matthew wants us to be impressed by Jesus because these wise men are impressed by Jesus. Matthew is the checklist gospel. Luke has humble shepherds, the last becoming first to see God. Both Gospels had to get Jesus from Bethlehem to fulfill the King David prophecy connection to Nazareth, where everyone knew Jesus was from. Matthew does this by having Herod slaughter two-year-olds. Matthew's writing for Jews who hated Herod anyway, so hey, common villain. Luke instead does this with a Roman census. Luke is writing for the world, most of which he believes to be Roman. The star, the gold, the frankincense, the myrrh, that's Matthew. It's old prophecy stuff. The manger, the inn, that's Luke. That is Jesus, God, the first becoming last, a humble birthplace. Matthew's angel talks to Joseph, head of a traditional paternal household. Luke's angel talks to Mary, a surprise, a subversion, the last becoming first. When Matthew writes about the virgin birth, he is working with a possible mistranslation of Isaiah 7:14, or at least an intentional translation choice. He's referring back to a verse that most modern scholars would say refers to a young woman giving birth to God's servant, not necessarily a virgin woman. Matthew's checking another prophecy box and moving on. Luke also writes about it, but Luke is doing something bigger. The mystical virgin mother is one of those things that pops up in lots and lots and lots of old stories and mythologies and religions, and even Alexander the Great's origin story, Artemis in Greece, a ton of them. So when Greeks and Romans read Luke's Mary, they say, oh yeah, we know what this means, right? Matthew and Luke do have one thing in common, though. At the time, they weren't writing to establish a holiday ceremony. Neither mentions the time of year. You could infer from Luke's shepherds being out that it was warm, not cold, but the newborn Jesus does not say Christmas due in remembrance of me, and angels do not say, don't say happy holidays to each other. They made their story choices so they could share their views of Jesus and win specific audiences, not to add to a religious calendar. But speaking of religious calendars, it is Christmas time. With that, I don't know how many minutes I made it in. Hopefully it wasn't too many over budget. Call it in. Christmas. What was Christmas like for you as a kid, Emily?
Well, Christmas morning in my house, we had five kids. So that took a while in itself, just gathering five kids around. But we were very poor, so it was really only a couple of gifts. And then we would always go over to my grandma's house. And that's where all my cousins would gather. My mom was one of four kids. I think we had like 19 grandkids or something like that growing up. So that was the best part of the day every year. And then we would always reenact the Christmas story at my direction.
Because this was before you went to like drama in high school.
And... Yeah, I was a theater nerd, but when I was a kid, I was the one that always made sure that we put on a little Christmas play.
Hey, we have guests on the show. In addition to our many Patreon associate pastors, thank you for being here with us today. Let's go ladies first. Sarah Cannon, hello, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you guys?
Sarah is an Episcopal Sunday school teacher, Moon Crew caretaker, etc. Thank you for being here. Sarah, same question for you. What Christmas memories? What are those?
So a lot of my Christmas memories involve traveling, actually. I live in Texas. My immediate family, my parents and my siblings and I all live in Texas. I was born and raised in the Carolinas, and flights are a lot cheaper on Christmas Day than before or after. So Christmas would happen in the morning, and then we would basically go right to the airport. And as a kid, I remember that being like the longest morning ever. But I'm sure for my parents, it was like basically as soon as we got up. And then a lot of times we would basically leave right for the airport. And then we would go back to wherever we were going and have Christmas again at that place. So it was very hectic. I don't really remember a lot of like table drama around the like meal, none of that. Just a lot of like planes, a lot of Christmases we would get sick on the trip. There was a Christmas where we all got sick. It wasn't like the most peaceful of experience every year, but it was certainly like entertaining.
I feel like this is very authentic. Like if you're in a stable, you know, in the cold outside, people are going to get sick. So this was very, very pious of you.
Yes, very much so.
Let's go with establishment of denomination order next. Richard Johnson, my associate at various websites and product, RJ underscore writes on Twitter. How are you doing, pal?
Doing good.
Richard's avatar is also sporting a Santa hat, but we couldn't have the Santa hat here tonight, but it's here in spirit.
Yeah, the Santa hat would not fit over my hair, I found out about 15 minutes ago, so.
That's fine. I mean, I look at you and I see it anyway. It's just like a halo.
You were one with the hat.
The Santa hat thing, was that a tradition for you?
Honestly, no. It's just in my apartment. My girlfriend actually put it on my TV. I am really big. Like, I'm really big on like my holiday traditions. I'm not going to say I don't know why, because I do know why, because my mom is, even though she doesn't act like she is. I sort of have sort of like set my watch things to my year. I'm big on Christmas, but Christmas doesn't start until after Thanksgiving. Day after Thanksgiving is the wave. Like that's when I will run Christmas carols from, you know, day after from Black Friday until, you know, a Boxing Day. my parents are from South America. So I guess I have like a sort of unconventional Christmas, a little bit. Christmas Eve is a really big deal, because my best friends growing up, our neighbors growing up, my best friends growing up, is a girl who's my age and then her little brothers. And so they have like a big family, a big Cuban family, crazy Cuban family. And we would go over to her house on Christmas Eve and we would eat pernil and rice and beans and just like hang out on Christmas Eve. And then either, so my mom was a night nurse, and sometimes she would work on Christmas Eve just because the schedule sort of fell that way. So I would go to midnight mass with them, or if she was off, me and her would go to church together. I grew up Methodist. And so we would go to church, the 11 o'clock church where you like finish holding the candle up, singing Silent Night type thing. And then Sunday morning, like I've never been a ton of gifts kid, or I never was a ton of gifts kid. It was usually one like banger gift. Like I remember Scooter Christmas was pretty good. GameCube Christmas was the NCAA football with Larry Fitzgerald on the cover.
Okay. That's a good Christmas. So
that I got that GameCube and NCAA football. iPhone Christmas was the other one. Wow. That was massive. Like iPhone 3 Christmas. Those are the big ones. But like, it's funny because we sort of get it out of the way. Me and my mom will sit and we'll eat garlic pork, which is something that she would make when she was a kid. We would like eat brunch, presents, brunch, and then like sort of done. Because sometimes my mom would either be coming off of work or about to go to work later that day. So we would sort of get it done in the morning or whatever. And then I would just chill. And if she was going to work, I would just like watch basketball all day. So just like, my Christmas is a little bit unconventional, but like Christmas, like I am very much about, like my tree is like in a spot in my apartment so that I can see it from where I'm sitting right now, which is in my second spare bedroom / office.
Ours is, I think. There
yeah,
you
can see.
Ours is behind me. Here's ours. And she is all, her and Evie, they are also very much, the tree stays up until March, folks. And like, I've come around to it, sure. I agree with you on, let's start at Advent. We will not, yeah. Thanksgiving deserves its time.
We did put it up before Thanksgiving this year.
Because who cares? Because it's 2020.
Well, we had to get a new tree too. And it was like, well, we brought it in. We might as well put it up.
Yeah, I have done my fair share that. When I was a kid, there was like the Christmas plays and stuff like that. Like there was a picture that exists somewhere of me like in like shepherd's sort of cane or whatever. I think I read the Christmas story in sort of like the Christmas Eve service before. I'm with it. I'm there. And it's funny. I love that you sort of brought up Luke, Jason, because Luke, when I was a kid, Luke, for some reason, Luke always appealed to me. when I was a kid, and I don't think I ever realized why until I became a journalist. And it's because everybody says, like, what everybody was trying to explain about Luke is that Luke was like a journalist. And I never like put that together until I sort of started to get older. And I was like, oh, like I recognize that because like, oh, that's probably how I write it.
Yeah. Luke, and even in the intro, Luke is like, I have done the research and I'm assembling sources here. Like there's this whole intro where he's like explaining like, all right, folk, like he's addressing it to his audience and everything. And like, yeah. whereas most books of the Bible, just like blurting, God says, you know, but Luke is like, I have sources.
I have a memory of Luke as well. I'm so glad you mentioned it too. When I was, how old would I have been? Like, I don't know, 10. We did a Christmas pageant at church, and it wasn't like the best Christmas pageant ever. It was like liturgical. So there were passages that we had to read, and I didn't get to be Mary. I was very disappointed about that, of course, but I think that they had me play Elizabeth. And I think that like looking back on it, I think it was because I could like read, because they made me read Elizabeth's, like her passage from Luke, where she talks about when Mary comes in and the child inside me leapt for the spirit of the Lord or whatever. And it's like a beautiful passage, but they made me wear like a pillow under my little like acolyte's tunic that was going to be my robe. And so I walk out there and I have my speech all memorized, and I'm such a serious, I was bookish. That's how I would put myself. So it's very earnest. And I was like ready to give my speech, and I get out there and everyone started laughing. And I was so upset. And I was like, Dad, why were they laughing at me? And he was like, because you were 10 years old and you had like a pregnant belly. And you were like reading this story and you're like this little girl. But I said my speech and I was proud of it. I will not be shamed for the Elizabeth speech.
It's only a few years younger than Mary, probably quite a few younger than Elizabeth. But
yeah, true.
The funny thing is my growing up, so Gainesville is 90 minutes from Jacksonville. You can make it more than 90. You can barely make it more than 90 minutes. And growing up, the way Nazareth and Bethlehem were always portrayed was from Gainesville to Jacksonville. I swear to God, they would always say I think it was roughly 90 miles, and they would say, oh, it's from here to Jacksonville. I swear. Growing up.
Which was which?
I cannot remember which was which.
That's spectacular.
That's amazing. Okay.
Okay. We are also joined by the recovering from laughter, Matt Brown, of the publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, and also a Sunday school teacher. Our first Latter-day Saints guest. Very excited to have on. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's going to take me a minute to recover from, I'm just like imagining the little map insert that's in all of our Bibles. That's like, and here's what like ancient Israel looked like. And the next page is like, and here's Jacksonville. Like, you know, how a very good place Christmas kind of thing. I appreciate that.
We're
supposed to liken the scriptures unto ourselves and our own experiences and worldviews. Duval would make sense for our people.
It's true. So Matt, what was Christmas like for you?
I'm a little jealous, I think, of some of y'all who have like these great Christmas traditions. And like, I say this with love as still somebody who's an active Latter-day Saint, but like my people are boring. We don't have this great tradition of like, there's no LDS midnight mass. There's not really the same Advent tradition. It's like, what if we took all of the really austere different parts of Christianity and then distill that like into you know this church, right? And that's kind of what it is on a day-to-day, on a week-to-week basis. So it didn't like feel that magical, especially because I don't come from a gigantic family. Like Richard, my mother is also, or was, from South America, and I grew up in Ohio, which is as far away spiritually as you can get from South America. So we didn't really have like big extended family anythings. Like I remember the church pageant. There's also a picture of me with a shepherd's crook and like a turban somewhere, and me just being bored out of my skull. And we did the same, you know, reading of Luke before Christmas, because my mom, I think, was desperate to try, like, all right, we did the whole like materialistic thing for like the past 30 days. Let's try to cram some church in here beforehand. And you know, none of us are really paying attention. I think the tradition angle has changed a lot now that I have children. I think particularly this year, because this has been kind of a drab year. Like, you know, so yeah, we set up the Christmas tree in like November 8th, and my girls are 6 and 2. And so we're just trying to, like, you know, throw a dump truck of Christmas magic on everything because the world hasn't been as magical. And I think it's a little bit more exciting to view it as a parent of young kids than maybe it was when you were 14 and kind of removed a little bit from some of those institutions, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I definitely see that. Like, seeing how much our kid loves Christmas is like, yeah, that's definitely the most exciting
she
thing
believes
about.
In all the magic of Christmas. Yeah. And I think that's a choice for sure.
Matt, I'm curious about this. And I honestly, I've always wondered if this sort of played along racial lines. Matt, was Santa a thing for you?
So this is interesting. Like, my dad, who is like, was like OG Mormon, super cracker gringo, like, this is why my last name is Brown and not Figueredo, like, mega white guy, was very into Santa and played up Santa and made this a thing. And my mom hated Santa. Like, in my mom's perfect world, Santa would not exist. Santa in Brazil is different from, like, American Santa. Brazilian Santa has a Hawaiian shirt and Bermuda shorts, and he's got, like, chicks in bikinis, like, next to him all the time when he hangs out department stores. He's not, like, American Santa. But I think my dad won. The rule we have in our household right now for Santa is that Santa exists, but the best presents come from mom and dad.
That's
like, yeah. Santa is the one that brings the dental hygienic stuff and puts it in your stocking. And dad is the one that bought you Animal Crossing for Nintendo Switch.
I will say
that's kind of how was it in your house?
Well, one quick thing canon on this show is, of course, that Santa's real. So if you don't believe in God, so be it. But
sure.
Everyone here must agree that Santa's real.
That's fair. I had never really, Santa was never actively dispelled in my, like, there was never the, like, you know, somebody tells you that Santa's not real type thing. I just sort of always was like, no, like, my mom, like, puts the stuff under the tree. Like, I guess I was a very, like, real kid about sort of the way it went.
I would say cynical, Richard.
Yeah. Typical East Coast journalist trying to
New York lib crushing lib. Everyone's dreams. Everyone does the pageant. I was in the pageant once. I was a magi. I was like 6 with this big gray beard that looked so stupid and made me cry because I had to wear it. And I got a jeweled breastplate that, like, looking back, it's like, okay, they really did their research because this is from Exodus. This is like, they actually did a Jewish high priest breastplate. But the Magi weren't Jewish. They were like Persian or Armenian or something. But like, it was a good guess. And like, it, you know, it, at least it was something real.
So I have another memory of after I had graduated from being young enough to have to be in the Christmas pageant. Well, I say have to be. I very much wanted to be. I got to be an acolyte. And if you've ever been in like a liturgical church where they have like processionals and candles and things like that, there are like little children and high schoolers and such that do the candles and all that stuff. And doing it on Christmas was like, I just thought I was the hottest shit in the entire world. Because you got to do the special processional where you like, there were more like laps around the church, I want to say, because there were more choir people. So I had to like walk longer and I had to put my thing up in a special place behind the altar. And they were like, I had to be very careful with the candle because if you put it near the live greenery, it'll catch on fire in the church. And it was all very important. And I took it very, very seriously. And now I'm in charge of them under normal times. So. We've come full circle.
Christmas is just kind of a dangerous holiday. Like, there's candles and there's
trees that can catch on fire.
Yeah, there's trees that stay green that, you know, pine needles, that's explosive kindling. We're bringing it all inside and we're cramming it all next to each other.
I do have an explosive story on that front. Yeah, if we because I suspect that parts of rural Ohio, like where I grew up, share a spiritual affinity to Jacksonville. And the Florida man and the Ohio man are cousins, right? So I grew up not that far from the base of the Appalachian Mountains in Ohio, like the only half Brazilian like within like a county, right? But there wasn't a whole lot to do, and so what we would do, like me and a couple of my buddies, would spend all of January driving around town in the neighboring town looking for Christmas trees that people had discarded, and we would take them out to a buddy's farm. And so by the end of this, we have 45 Christmas trees, 50 Christmas trees, and we light them, bring them into this gigantic pyramid And of course, because dried pine needles are super combustible, you can't just go up there and light a match for this gigantic fire. So what we would do, you know, very Legend of Zelda, this is completely true, is we put a little bit of gasoline around the base, and then we would light an arrow on fire, like 50 yards away, and shoot the bow and arrow into this thing.
Wow.
And then it looks like a biblical explosion, right?
A
like
Viking funeral. I thought you said Mormons are boring.
Well, I mean, so there's, you know, there's like this, I wish I could say this was a Mormon thing. This is the two Mormons in the town and just a bunch of rednecks, right? Like, you know, we can't afford drugs. And so we're gonna just make a big fire. And apparently you're supposed to get permits for this sort of thing. The county fire department was not especially thrilled.
No, remember,
nobody
Mary
got
said,
hurt.
Mary said we are here to overthrow the power structure. We don't get permits.
But no, I mean, in a manner of speaking, this was overthrowing something. They are wonderful to start fires with. I don't recommend you do the Viking funeral thing in your municipality.
As we are legally required to say.
Can you imagine, like, if your kids did this?
I mean, I literally can't, because, like, you know, my little girls are still like, we want to completely emulate Disney princesses, and I right. can't imagine them like breaking any kind of law, especially like light arson. But if they did, I don't think I could be that angry.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was a good kid, but there are certain things that if I think about our kid doing that, I'm like, oh no. There are still a lot of things that I'm like, I would freak out if she did them.
Yeah, I was definitely more of a Christmas arson guy. So. Reverend Scott Johnson, you got anything? We have an actual pastor on here for once. I've been lying about being one this entire time. We have an actual pastor for a change.
Yeah, but I've already finished my first beer of the night, so it's all good, guys.
I'm working on it. So,
I was actually thinking, you were talking about Christmas being dangerous. My name's Scott Johnson. If any of you are members of the EDSBS community, you might know me as Go Big Rev on that over there. I'm like the polar opposite of Sarah. I grew up a mile away from the farm that my great great grandfather started in Nebraska. So Christmas was staying home for us, go to the same church that my grandparents and my great grandparents went to, so I did not do a lot of traveling for Christmas until I went to seminary in Minnesota, and then even then it was just back to Nebraska. But it was also it was a food related holiday for us. That side of my family is Swedish, and a lot of Swedes in the Midwest will do a lot of traditional foods like ostakaka and lutefisk, which it is cod that was actually shipped across the U.S. in lye originally to preserve it. And you obviously take it out of the lye and wash it off real good, and then you cook it. But no one actually eats lutefisk anymore except for weirdo Midwestern Scandinavian Lutherans. So like the Norwegians in Minnesota, the Swedes in Nebraska. But it is the most god-awful, disgusting stuff. it'll never actually be on my Christmas table, but I vividly remember my grandparents and my dad loved the stuff. And I don't even know where I would go to get it, much less how to prepare it. But it was some nasty shit, I'll tell you that. I think the biggest thing I would say from growing up, I grew up in Nebraska in the 1980s, which was not, and a farmer's kid in Nebraska in the 1980s, which was a pretty rough time. And it was only years later looking back that I realized, looking at the different Christmases that we celebrated when I was a kid, I can go back and I can tell you which years were good ones and which years we barely made it by what was under the tree. And there was one year in particular where my mom was a home ec teacher originally. So she would do all kinds of homemade crafts and stuff like that. She made us Christmas stockings, you know, with our names on them and stuff like that. And there was always really a lot of handmade stuff. But one year there was this gigantic stocking downstairs Christmas morning. And it was full of like little toys and food and stuff like that. And it was only years later I realized someone had probably given that to my folks. You know, either they had won some sort of contest or it was some sort of farmer's aid type of thing, because I'm sure there were years where my folks, you know, come the 20th or 21st of December, were like, we don't know what we're going to put under the tree. But somehow my family made it through when a lot of others didn't. And it's only looking back that I even remember that. But, you know, it's funny how you get that colored looking back on it as an adult, when as a kid, it's Christmas morning, man. I don't care what's under the tree. I'm going to have fun.
Yeah. Like, I don't remember ever as a kid being disappointed in Christmas. Like, yeah. No matter what you get.
It's interesting for me because I have a great memory in general, but I don't remember Christmas up until the time I was like maybe 8 years old. And I think a lot of that had to do with, I don't remember a lot of, we moved around a lot. My mom was a single mom until I was six. And I don't think she probably could even afford, we probably didn't even know it was Christmas half the time. Who knows? Other than school. But even like, we didn't have a TV, and I remember having to like, have an assignment where we had to go watch the news and write a paper, like write a paragraph I was younger. And it was like, I had to tell the teacher, like, we didn't have a TV. I couldn't do that. So she sent me home with a newspaper. But even things like that. So I would have had no idea of what was going on around me within my house. But then as I got older, my mom remarried, then we had Christmases. We were still poor, but I can remember like 1 year, my big gift was a pair of Converse. When we lived in a better house at one point, my big gift, or my only gift, was a CD player and the Lion King soundtrack. But like those are the things I remember. And I remember more Christmases, but not because of the gifts.
Yeah. And like, I think we see as parents that you put pressure on yourself to like, oh, it's got to be a special Christmas, you know? And
like, I feel like I'm making up for lost time with our kid. Usually it's like, I mean, I know that that's not what she's going to remember is the gifts necessarily, but it brings me so much joy to be able to gift things to people. Like, I love giving.
And we have to some degree compete with the grandparents, because,
oh yeah, they go really,
they
overboard.
Go hard. Good grief.
We're in that same boat. Yeah. It honestly makes me feel a little bit better to hear y'all talk about that, because I don't think it's an uncommon pressure for parents to be like, you know, I remember a couple of those Christmases. I remember the Sega Genesis Christmas, right? Or the 2XL Christmas, or like one of those couple of big things, and how that is when you're like nine, that's like a transformational euphoric moment. And you want to replicate that. But I think generally you remember like two or three of those things, and everything else kind of fades together. And you don't remember the individual gifts. You remember how you feel about Christmas. You remember the time with everybody else. And so you don't have to sweat that all that much, right? Like, I'm thinking the next couple of weeks, like, there's a decent chance my kids will forget what they actually got for Christmas a couple of weeks later. But they will remember how they felt about the event, which, if you think about it that way, can be, I think, a little bit more liberating as an adult. When you kind of take the pressure off a little bit, you know?
I'll give you something that'll definitely tell you how old I am. I don't remember a Sega Genesis Christmas. I remember an Atari 2600 Christmas.
Mine was American Girl Doll Christmas. That was a sweet day. I got Samantha, and I still have her. She's still in my parents' house. Yeah. Well, it's funny that Matt brought up the grandparents, and someone else brought the grandparents up too, because that definitely came into play. Like, I think Santa or my parents got me the first American Girl doll. But it was noticed that was a huge hit with me. I loved it. And that basically became the present from grandmother, like every year until I turned like 15. It felt like, some kind of American Girl doll variation, either another doll, like a thing for it. I'm sure if I wanted to, I could probably make a healthy profit off of these like vintage American Girl dolls, because many of them have been discontinued since. But you're so right that I remember the first one. The first American Girl Christmas was a special day.
I feel like in the moment, Christmas is definitely for the kids, but then looking back on it, it's for the parents or the adults in the situation, because you're the ones that remember those reactions from your kids, and you're the ones that remember like how happy they were or whatever, and those are the things that make you want to do it again the next year.
Can I ask a question of the group, actually? Because I just thought of another thing that went with Christmas when we were kids. I'm part of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and our churches in Nebraska had an orphanage that many of us supported. And we actually had a tradition when I was a kid that we actually brought gifts to the Christmas Eve service for the kids at the orphanage. Just it got tied to it directly. So I'm wondering, does anyone have any traditions either when you were a kid or now where you do something like Boxing Day or where you practice giving to people outside of your family or anything like that?
Well, so we have tried to do that. I've tried to do it with Evie at her old gym. They do like the angel tree every year. So we would always go pick out a kid and go shop for that child or something along those lines. Some years we just adopt a different family that may need it. But
yeah, it's a similar thing. My parents' home church does an adoptive family, which is sponsored by, I don't know if they sponsor it or if it's another like neighborhood nonprofit that they work with. So they do that. My workplace does that. I don't know what my church here in Austin does. But yeah, I can remember that being a part of it. And we would shop and then other volunteers would go and take it to them. I don't really know exactly how the handoff went.
I know that the church that we visit most frequently here, I think they used to do more of an angel tree. And then I think now it's kind of changed over the years, but they do like a tree in the foyer of the church or I don't even know that you can call it a foyer. It's massive. It used to be a Kmart.
A vestibule.
Yeah, but it's huge. It's like a very large area. But they do like these massive trees with kids on them. But I think that they get them from the local schools, if I'm not mistaken. So they can help through those avenues, which is nice because so many of the programs that I have found here anyway focus on like kids in foster care or specific types of kids, not just your everyday family that maybe has it rough. So because oftentimes those families don't really know how to access things for their kids because it's maybe not something that's normal for them or whatever. It's kind of difficult to just find those families that maybe aren't involved in some sort of organization outside.
My dad's church is in the past, and this is Justin Ferguson, recovering Southern Baptist. My dad's church is in the past and they still do now to this day, Operation Christmas Child, which I believe is through Samaritan's Purse, which I guess used to be cooler before Franklin Graham fell off the deep end. But basically what you would do is you'd get a shoebox and you'd fill it up with like these small presents, and they would you would send them in, and they'd send it all over the world to kids who were like third world countries and stuff like that. And one of the traditions we had growing up is before we did any Christmas shopping for like each other or for like family members or anything like that. I grew up, I have five brothers and sisters. We would all get a shoebox and we would have to go like, you know, fill it up. And that was like our first, cause you have to get them in pretty early, to make sure they get out there for Christmas. So yeah, before we did any like Christmas presents or, you know, for ourselves, we had to, you know, do that and load them up and send them all over the world. And that was always pretty cool. Sometimes you would get like notes back and updates, you know, dad would get them through the church saying like, here's where these shoeboxes went and stuff like that. So it's really cool. I mean, I think that's a big thing to kind of like reinforce that, that giving spirit in Christmas, because, you know, especially for kids, because growing up, even if you grew up in church, a lot of times it's still like me, you know, what am I getting for Christmas and all that. And I guess the Southern Baptist angle there is that you'll send it to the person on the other side of the world, but not like the person down the street. So
right.
There
you go. Right. Lottie Moon's got this.
It's funny you guys mentioned this, because I feel like that attitude is kind of tracks with my LDS upbringing. It kind of bothered us as a family growing up, because I think institutionally our church does a really good job and places a lot of emphasis on welfare programs and looking after people. But generally that's within the church itself. Like if you are an LDS person and you're down on your luck, there are a lot of pathways for you to get a bunch of groceries and a employment counselors and all these people coming to help you. And I've been involved on both sides of that angle of giving and receiving, and it's wonderful. But to encourage people to do that for your community at large, that hasn't really been a part of any congregation that I've been to throughout the country. So we haven't had that so much around Christmas. I think it's supposed to be like, that's just something you're supposed to be doing year round. But what our family's done is here in Chicago, the Chicago Sun-Times, one of the newspapers here, does a letters to Santa program for people that are down on their luck. The kids will write a letter to Santa. The newspaper then distributes the letter to Santa to a newspaper reader. And then as a family, you answer that letter to Santa, and then you fulfill those Christmas wishes. So we've done that, and then shopped for other little kids and trying to kind of beat that into our children's skulls that this is supposed to be a time to look outward beyond just inward And, you know, to what extent that sinks into a six-year-old, who knows? But I think it's something that we've been glad to do since it doesn't exist as easily within our particular congregation.
Anything else on that? I got another book to tell y'all about.
Oh boy.
any last thoughts on any of that stuff?
I just want to ask some of y'all talking about doing Christmas programs, Christmas plays. Y'all were probably people who had talent growing up, or at least somebody told you that you did, or you felt like you had to.
We pretended.
For those uncreatives like us, did any of y'all ever have to participate in or go to a outdoor nativity scene?
Buddy, living yes. nativity, son.
Yes, there we
I'll
go.
Tell you something about it. Living nativity. I can't remember where it was, but it's about an hour away from Gainesville. They did like a living nativity, like donkey, baby, everything in the thing. Yeah, I do remember living nativity. I also remember there is the sport, like on the pageant realm, there was a Baptist church in Gainesville that did, they call it a living Christmas tree. And it was just a big like set, Christmas tree set. And that was like the showpiece of the pageant. And that church, they moved sanctuaries, got a new sanctuary, and the tree wouldn't fit into the sanctuary, or for some reason they weren't able to do it. I guess the roof was too low. And so they had to like reorient the whole Christmas pageant. I think they just like built a different one or something, but it was like talk of the town for a little bit.
So we had a drive-through nativity at our church that we grew up in, because there was like a big winding road, like kind of around the church, property. So they would like build these scenes just out in the middle of like the grounds behind the church, and people would kind of just drive through and just, look at, Bible stuff. And so if you couldn't sing or you couldn't do anything like that, we, those of us, that was our showtime, and like we had to dress up like Bible people. And I remember they had me one time, I basically had to walk back and forth. I was like doing walking suicides, like across like a, like a town scene, just because it's like, all right, don't stay still, but don't, wow. act like you're, but the worst part of it though, was one of my younger siblings got to be an angel, and to pull off the whole angel, hey, look, there's an angel in the sky. They put him in a bucket truck and just stuck him up in the air. It's the most redneck South Alabama thing you could think of. Just put him up in the air, 30 degrees. There was one year where it like rained and they were just standing up there, just freezing to death. Just wearing,
and they up
like
there the whole time saying, glory to God in the highest. Everything is wonderful now.
it was crazy. And like I grew up in a small town, which was so bizarre to me. Cause like I didn't get the appeal of it, because it was just like, hey, it's just a bunch of people we know just standing out in the field looking like Jesus and Mary and Joseph. And like, yeah. And if you were those of us who didn't get to be in the big scenes, you were just townsfolk, and just the townsfolk just stand in a field and act like you're, in Bible times. And so, I guess for those of us who had no actual talent, that was our showtime.
We all contribute. We all have our own gifts of the Spirit. We, for some of us, it's risking your life
in a bucket,
200 feet in the air, becoming a first century martyr for the Lord.
So this is Alex Simon here. I grew up Catholic in California, and I will say that the nativity scenes that are being discussed were not necessarily the biggest thing for white Catholics in California, but they were absolutely enormous for the Latinx population. And almost every single year, there was a giant setup. They would find it almost in every town, honestly. If you had a Catholic church and they had a huge Latino or Latina population, that would be a massive thing. And it was always cool to like see the setup. I went once, I think, with a friend, but never necessarily like it was a family thing. And so I assume that's also, Our Lady of Guadalupe, and the feast day of that is also around Christmas time. So there's a lot of decorations that happen in the Catholic Church that kind of overlap between the two in that way. So that the month of December is very big in the Catholic Church if you have multiple different practicing groups in that way.
I don't remember ever doing or seeing a live nativity until I moved here. And I've
never heard of this.
It must be It must be a Georgia Bama thing then.
I don't know. We did a drive through of Christmas lights and it was horrible. Like we waited like 2 hours in this car line to get in, and then it was like a mile of lights, but the lights were spaced like 500 yards apart.
I love that Georgia, you know, in Metro Atlanta, and you spend all your time in traffic, and then what do you do for Christmas?
Let's go get in
some more traffic.
Well, my sister won free tickets on the radio or something, on the Christian radio station, I believe. And so we went because it was like you pay for the carload. So we just all piled into her van and it was awful. And then the only thing that the kids really cared about was that there was a live nativity because they'd never seen one. So
a donkey.
The only time I've ever seen one.
let's see. All right. Here is a book, The Origins of Christmas by Joseph Kelly. Speaking of things that are bigger for Catholics. All right. Let's go back to the time when there were only Catholics. So Christmas wasn't really a thing until about 300 years after Jesus. Obviously, they were aware that he had entered the world. They were aware that that was important, and they were interested in figuring out which day. But there is this debate, like, you know, we would like to celebrate Jesus's entry into the world. And there's also people saying, like, no, don't treat him like a king. Don't act like a pagan. Jesus wouldn't want a party, right? So, like, there's this argument. And people threw around all sorts of days based on all sorts of January 6th, March 25th, March 28th, April 19th, April 20th, April 21st, May 21st, etc. I think Rasta Jesus would like that April 20th mark. People started to really like March 25th. It's spring solstice. Jesus is here to renew. This is an easy story. And then someone realizes Matthew and Luke say Jesus was God at conception. So that means add 9 months. Voila, December 25th. And outside, this book is really good, but outside this book, some scholars say, like, yeah, that's, you know, it's a nice theory. We don't really know. March 25th, that becomes Annunciation, the day that Jesus enters Earth. And January 6th, that still lingers for some Christians as Christmas. For others, it's Epiphany. December 25th, that ends up being, according to theories, a fortunate choice because the Roman Empire at the time, they're still around. That's crazy. 300 years later, Roman Empire is still around. They're trying to unite their billion overlapping pantheons into one religion, Sol Invictus, one sun god to rule them all. The emperor installs this new religion on December 25th. These things, it's possible they merge in some ways. You can find all sorts of theories and arguments one way or the other. But it's a good story, so let's go wild with it. Also happening in late December in the Roman Empire, there is Saturnalia, a seven-day festival all about overturning social order, which, as we learned from Luke, that is key to Christmas as well. In Saturnalia, masters have to obey their servants. Everyone gets to party instead of work. The last become first. It was in the 300s when various Christian churches start accepting December 25th as Christmas. And meanwhile, the Christianizing Roman Empire is merging the party time, the purge party time, with Christmas festivals. And this is fun because ancient people often took scripture extremely literally. Like, they're, you know, the ancients, they say Moses lived to be 120 years old. Okay, that means exactly 120 years to the second after he was born. That's when he died. Just boom, right? It doesn't say 120 years and 10 minutes. No, like a lot of people took stuff that way. So when it says Jesus was born at night, that means midnight. Therefore, we have midnight mass. We still have midnight mass. They called it Christ's mass, Christmas. That's where the name comes from. From this book also, there's a part about Matthew's Star of Bethlehem. And since we know, based on when Herod died, Jesus was born around 6, 5 or 4 BC, Jesus was born before Christ, go with it. Modern astronomers can go back and find some stuff that might have been what Matthew was talking about up in the sky that he had the Magi pointing at, like a bunch of planets grouped together in the constellation Pisces, or some supernovas and comets that Chinese astronomers were recording at the time. There's one in the year 6 BC. Jupiter was right by the moon in the eastern sky, the biblical direction, and some people tie it to ancient Greek astrology, which Matthew's Magi would have probably known about, and Matthew really liked to make connections between religions. So the star, that could be there. Other thing here. So Matthew, when he is constantly referring back to the Hebrew Bible, this encouraged a lot of other Christians to do the same. And Matthew really opened the floodgates there. We've already kind of talked about it. Picture the typical nativity scene. The first animal we think of as being there is...
Donkey. Yay, I got it right.
So the donkey, the famous Christmas donkey that is in every nativity scene, is not from the Gospels. It is from Isaiah 1. And if you read Isaiah 1, you think, How in the world did they decide this donkey was at the nativity? Okay, fine. In every nativity scene, the Magi are there. They are riding camels, which are from Isaiah 60. And it does not say at the birth of Jesus there will be Magi riding camels. There's just no, it just mentions camels and someone decides it's connected. The manger being in or near a cave, this is from the non-canon Gospel of James, extended universe lore that adds a lot to Mary's story. The Gospel of James also, so the star in a nativity scene, it's not like special star, it's like sky-consuming gigantic star. That's from the Gospel of James. The Magi being kings, we three kings of Orient, the kings part is from Isaiah 60. They were scholars. They weren't kings. Isaiah 60 has something about kings. The reason we think there are three Magi kings, Matthew doesn't tell us how many Magi there are. The number three comes from Genesis 26 and is the biggest stretch of all because it's about like Jacob making friends. It's amazing. So, you know, we have this whole song, We Three Kings of Orient Are, and almost all of it is a lie. Orient, that could mean east. They got that part right. They're probably Persian. So good job on that part. Also, when the Magi arrive in Matthew, King Herod wants to kill two-year-olds, not newborns. Herod and the Magi think Jesus was already 2 years old. Not only are we three kings, not three or kings, they probably weren't even at the Nativity. So this whole part of the Nativity, if we base it on just what is in the Gospels, there's no donkey, no camels, no Magi. The star is, you know, not a nuclear mushroom cloud in the sky. It's just an interesting star. But you know, the picture's nice, so throw it all in. Last thing from this book, at the Council of Nicaea in the year 325, when the Catholics really gather and start deciding everyone else is wrong, 318 bishops were there. One of them was a guy from a seaport town in Asia Minor. He died in, like, December after that. It's probably an important month. As always, people need superheroes. So seaport guy, he becomes a saint of sailors. If you're a saint of sailors, you soon become a saint of travelers, which means your story spreads. His legend grows. People tell stories of him hiding bags of gold for poor children, taking care of orphans. Asia Minor's geography, well, it's right next to Europe. So as Christianity spreads into Europe, this guy becomes a big deal in Europe as well. By the year 3000, by the year 1000, not to Revelation yet, we'll stick with 1000. This guy's a big deal all over Europe. In 1812, New Yorkers who wanted to feel like they had some old European roots decided this guy, St. Nicholas, had been a Dutch superhero and was now an American superhero. And voila, some guy who'd been at the Catholics' first clubhouse meeting 1,500 years earlier is revealed as Santa Claus.
New York invented Christmas.
New York invented Christmas. Thank you, New York. I mean, like when Mary went to the bodega To pick up food for Jesus. The rest of us can't understand. She said, let me get a paper towel and a baby.
Some peanut butter M&Ms, Diet Coke.
For my camels.
Can't get that anywhere else.
I will say though, I will put on for New York at Christmas time. If anybody's got kids or whatever, and you know, when we get a chance to travel, it is really cool here at Christmas. The city really has done up pretty well, and you like going to Manhattan, but also there is an insane neighborhood in South Brooklyn that does lights. It's called Dyker Beach. Yeah, baby. And they basically, my theory is that it's like where the mob money is, in the city at least, because really nice houses with nuts light setups. Like if you go like on Instagram, like go on Instagram and like just like Instagram search Dyker Heights and you'll see the lights. It's absolutely insane. But yeah, New York on Christmas is quite nice.
Yeah, I'm going to back up Richard here as another New Yorker on the call. This is Sean, raised Catholic, did a little evangelical spill. Now I'm interdenominational, but like Christmas in New York is truly great in so many ways. And in all the ways that you think it's great are the ways that it's not great. Like, the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade is garbage. Like, don't go. Like, you really, like, you don't see anything anyway. But, like, even just
unless you have a friend in an office or an apartment that overlooks the parade,
you're right. 100%. If you get like the overhead view, you're good to go. And if you're on the street, same with New Year's, garbage. Just don't ever do it. But I will say that, like, there is just, and I know this is like New York propaganda a little bit, but like whether it's in Dyker or just walking down like Christmas windows or Central Park when people are actually out, like can't really replicate this in a pandemic. Like there is just a spirit in the air, and it's the winter markets around town too. Like really, really, really great place to be. can't recommend it highly enough.
Have we done a town around Christmas that was especially cool?
In Kansas City, we would always go find like the neighborhoods with the good lights, or there's a like really ritzy neighborhood called Mission Hills. George Brett lived there. Yeah. And that's where we also like to go trick-or-treating. But they always had fancy lights. And then I would go to my dad's parents. My dad wasn't always there, but my dad's parents, whenever they did their Christmas gathering, that was amazing because they were Polish and German. And so we always had really good food from all my grandparents and aunts and uncles that created all of that. So povetitsa is like my Christmas time memory that I wish that we had here, but we don't. So
what is it?
It's like a bread that's like rolled out and layered, and it's got like walnuts and cinnamon and all these delicious things woven into it. It's really good. You can order it for me from Strawberry Hill Povetitsa.
No, I'll make it.
No, he's not very good at making things. FYI, he can smoke things, but he's not very good at cooking.
Meat, that is not. Yeah. Jesus was not born on April 20. Let me run through another book real quick. The Battle for Christmas by Stephen Nissenbaum. This one is it's basically picks up where the other one left off. It's like once we get to England and America. So that Saturnalia spirit of the last becoming first, of servants becoming the bosses for a time, that lived on. England took it all the way. They went soccer hooligan with it. Christmas for a long time was about poor people caroling about beating up rich people who didn't give them booze. If rich people didn't give them booze, then they followed through. That's where caroling comes from. Christmas purge. It was this accepted social upheaval where rich people were like, fine, let them blow off steam because we don't have security systems and doors don't lock very well here in the medieval years. And then, you know, like Jesus said, the first will become last. If you don't let them, then they will burn your house down. Jesus didn't say that part, but I think it's implied. Get to America. The Puritans don't like Christmas because they don't like anything. People partying and taking off work, that is disgusting. So it becomes a battle between the Puritans and the Anglicans who miss the old holidays. The Anglicans have an ally because America also has drunk poor people who like to sing until rich people give them booze. We reach the 1820s. The Unitarians and the Methodists are pushing Christmas as a religious holiday, which feels like an insane thing to say. But Christmas had always been around. It had been through so many evolutions that they were like, hey, you know, this day named after Jesus, you know what we could do? We could go to church. Wouldn't that be something? And the Puritans are like, what, you're going to close businesses? Disgusting. This is also around the time Christmas starts becoming a commercial holiday. Christmas gifts weren't really a thing until the mid-1800s. If you wanted to give someone something for Christmas, you gave money to poor people. Then that becomes internalized within the household. And whenever an old person says Christmas wasn't commercialized back when they were kids, just know their grandparents told them the same thing. Their great-great-great-grandparents might have a different story. So the old Puritan-Anglican tension had been updated, letting people take off work to be with their families versus needing people to spend money. And that brings us to current times. Washington Irving, the storyteller, imported St. Nicholas, creating our mascot of commerce, who is a demigod who rewards children for their good behavior. Again, sealing all the Christmas magic within the household instead of spreading it around the community via social upheaval. Charles Dickens did what he could, but Amazon.com won. That's Christmas. Let's see. I think we are close to time. So let me hit one more. This one, 4,000 Years of Christmas by Earl and Alice Lawson Count. It's like the other two, the Battle for Christmas is scholarly and heavy. Like it's a dense read. This one, 4,000 Years of Christmas, it's pretty flighty and fanciful. You got to read with a little bit of a grain of salt. It makes some like big dubious claims that, sure. like, for example, you know, everyone knows Roman Saturnalia, the festival about the end of the year, the last becoming first, that associated with Christmas. This argues, oh, that's actually a Greek thing. That's actually a Persian thing. It's actually a Babylonian thing. It's taken it way, way, way back to this 12-day December festival that we talked about on our Passover episode about the world beginning anew, a chosen one reuniting humans with heaven, a man on death row getting to be king for a day, the last becoming first. This thing keeps coming up. This book also connects goes reaches to Norse mythology, which is Christianized, you know, about halfway between Jesus and now. Norse mythology, you have the terrifying but good-hearted All-Father Odin, who rides a flying horse across the winter night sky. The All-Father has a big gray beard and a hat and disguises himself among people. So this argues that Odin plus Asian bishop named Saint Nicholas equals Santa Claus. So how'd that Saint Nicholas get powers? Well, for a long time, because he was a sailor, they associated him with Poseidon. So they gave him magic water powers. And then maybe we also turned him into Odin. So Santa's a very powerful guy. This book also traces Christmas trees and wreaths and candles to ancient demon warding festivals. In Scandinavia, people would bring green plant life into their homes to remind themselves and the demons that the whole world had not died in winter. Christmas trees actually appear to have been invented in Germany and in America around 1850, but the thought is nice. This book, the thing I like about it is true in spirit. We do these things in December, not just because of Jesus or Santa or Hallmark or Coca-Cola. We do these things in December because we do these things in December. Because an end is here, the harvest is in, the factory is out, school is out. Our loved ones are either near or far. The rich people have made their money. We have hungry people to feed, and a new beginning is here. We have always done these things in December because an old year is ending. We have an old year's worth of mourning, but no matter the year, it gave us things to cherish. We also have a new year to fear, and it is always darkest before the dawn. But no matter what, we have a new year full of hope. Because for thousands of years, whether in America or Rome or Bethlehem or Babylon or anywhere else on God's gray earth that will one day be green again because it always is, the reason for the season has always been this: the last shall become first, and all old things shall be made new. And that's Christmas. What else we got? We got a little more time here if y'all got time.
Yeah, hey, this is Aaron. Wanted to share this because I don't know if you're following Twitter, but Georgia is a verb sent to the VBS podcast. The live nativity scene / Christmas Eve children's service when I was 5 or 6 in the fancy Episcopal Cathedral here was the giggle of the town for weeks afterwards because the camel took a shit in the aisle of the fellowship hall during the closing procession. That is all.
Yeah, I mean, if you invite a camel, it's...
camel doing camel things.
Where do you get a camel?
I mean, I don't know.
They're very difficult, but you can rent them even in South Alabama. So,
Justin, I'm going to trust you as our camel guy.
Yeah.
Experience on
the heart, the heart of camel country, coming down Alabama.
Last year, I got kind of surprised with tickets to the Rockettes Christmas Spectacular. And I did not know this at the moment or at the time, but there are also camels in that production. Like live camels, and I was very confused on like how live camels like made it into New York City.
I was also rather taken aback. I went with my mom a couple years ago.
Yeah, it is to Richard's point earlier, like it is an awesome show. And I saw when I walked around after the show, basically like a horse trailer-esque situation where the camels were getting walked in. So there was some situation where like that camel was making a one night only appearance in the city, might be out or one of the more rural counties like Ulster, like around New York, and then just comes in. So I don't know if it's an every night situation or if there's just an area around, but they find a way to get those camels in and out.
I don't know if y'all remember the Crystal Cathedral, this gigantic church out in California. The first couple of years that I was a pastor, I don't remember exactly when, but somewhere in there they went bankrupt actually. And this was a gigantic church. It's currently, I think, the cathedral for the Diocese of Los Angeles now. But back then, when they went bankrupt, they showed their annual budget. And like I said, it was my first or second year as a pastor, and they kind of had some line items in the paper. And I realized that my annual salary in the church that I was serving at that time was less than what the Crystal Cathedral paid for animal rental for their Christmas program that they put on every year. So,
hey, so hi, Andrew. I grew up in Southern California, and I went to the Glory of Christmas one year, which is the Crystal Cathedral Christmas musical, and yes, there were many, many animals that were for that presentation.
It feels a little hilariously on the nose for a church to spend an overwhelmingly large amount of money on camels, given what we know about rich people and camels. That seems like a little bit too blunt of a metaphor there.
Yeah, if you can afford a hobby camel, you might want to read the verse.
Honestly, it kind of looks like a Viking stadium. Currently,
I will say,
the Crystal Cathedral.
Yes. In I guess like the line item of churches spending too much money on Christmas related things, and I was debating sharing this earlier, but I feel like now's a better time to do it. When I grew up, one of my Christmas memories is I was in the children's choir in a Catholic church. And this is roughly around the same time as like the boy band boom. And I grew up right outside Orlando, and they took us in to record a Christmas album. And it wasn't like we were like a mega church or like anything like that. Like it was just like the local church, like probably a small pressing for like our parents. But like, it is, I like barely remember it because I was in like fourth grade and we sang like Wonderful Counselor or something. I think the children's choir just got like one song, but it was like, I still kind of have enough in my mind to like I don't know how much of it was actually what happened in the studio when I was recording with the choir and how much of it was the SNL like more cowbell skit, but like all of my like recording studio experience is all like a mashup of those two things just in my head.
Well, with the amount of animals we have here, it might have been like literally a cow with a, you know, with a cowbell. Are you saying your boy band experience, you don't want that in the episode? It's because someone will go,
you know, so Justin was talking about people with talent, and I didn't really feel like I qualified as like a, you know, boy soprano. You know, we were talking about like the levels of O-Town and LFO were coming out at that time with the Orlando scene. The All Souls Children's Choir, I think, just wasn't on the same level.
There was
but how many of them had cows?
There was a Christian boy band. There were several, right? I'm trying to think. Like there's a Christian Backstreet Boys.
There has to be.
Yeah, I'm certain there were at least attempts. Richard, are you our ranking church musician here by chance?
Yeah, there's some guitar in my church guitar in my background. Some church singing in my background, some Christian Christian rock, I mean, I guess is the genre, the family at least. Yeah, there's some of that.
I would also, this is Alex once again, like to point out that I was the longest serving tone bell player in my Catholic church.
Nice.
That's a good job. That's a good gig.
I was never like in the church choir or anything like that. I mean, I did whenever we had, and not necessarily pageants, but like special music or something, we would do stuff. But I grew up in a bluegrass band with my brothers and my grandpa. And so we would always play whenever there was something special going on at the church. We were always hired to play. Or multiple churches, not just our own.
So we, me and my idiot dirtbag friend, my fellow idiot dirtbag friends, we always had one or another punk band or rap group or screamo band or metal band. Or were we any good enough at it to really distinguish between those? Let's say all at once. We always had one of those going on at a time. And it was always at least theoretically vaguely Christian. And we got hired to do a like, it wasn't Christmas, but it was a lock-in in December. It was like a Christmas-themed lock-in, and we were going to be the like all-night band entertainment. And this was a new version of the band that didn't have any songs yet. And it's like, well, couldn't you just do songs from the band you were all, the same people were in 2 weeks ago? I'm like, no, this is a whole new project. It sounds totally different. So we get on stage without any songs, and we were just making stuff up. There was probably freestyle rapping. There was like, you know, imitating David Bowie. Like, it was just a horrible mess, and at some point it's on purpose, right? But we got kicked out of Christmas lock-in for sucking too bad at music, so that's an achievement unlocked.
I probably have pictures of this somewhere. I mean, I wasn't there, we didn't know each other yet, but we have a box of old photos.
Yeah, there really might be.
I think we might have one.
Yeah, just look for the orange camo
pants. I'm pretty sure we do.
That would have been like new metal era, so look for orange camo
and
pants.
He's just like screaming into a microphone. So
for the Lord,
when I find it, I'll show you all.
Oh, shit, you do have that power now.
Yeah,
this is Tyler. I grew up in what I would refer to as Lights and Big Drums Church, and so a lot of our Christmas concerts were along the lines of like Third Day showing up and playing a set. So I identify very strongly with the weird feeling of like I think this is Christmas, but also I feel like I probably should have paid to like get into this. So I'm a little jealous of all y'all talking about like Christmas pageants and like 8-year-olds being up on stage, but very, very different experience over here.
Tyler, I can like kind of vouch for that less around Christmas, but growing up in Orlando, like Night of Joy and Rock the Universe were like big things every
year. Yes.
And yes. Like, I would remember that as thinking like, oh, do I need to pay for this? But it was always like couched as like a youth group trip. So like my parents would like front it because, you know, it's a youth group trip. It's totally fine. But also we're going to Disney for the day. And then also like Jeremy Camp and Hawk Nelson
yep.
and Reliant K were playing.
Yeah. What was the thing in Nashville? Like Winterfest or whatever it was that they'd bring everybody to, and it was in like Nashville or Gatlinburg or whatever that was.
Yeah. It's the one in Gatlinburg. I'm like, we went there every year.
Gatlinburg is extreme, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Rock the Universe is funny because it's always, it's like the second weekend in September usually. So I like, because I am from obviously a town home to an SEC school, it's Florida playing a really bad team. And so they're always, we would always get in trouble because we would try to like get to a restaurant on City Walk or like stay at the hotel or something to watch like what equated to like the first like two quarters maybe of Florida smacking like Ball State or something.
Richard, when I was on my mission, I figured out what kind of houses were going to have TVs so I could go knock on doors and sneak in and like, oh, you don't want to talk about Jesus? That's fine. What's the Ohio State Minnesota score? Like, we found hustles to kind of figure out like which kind of restaurant is going to have a TV up there. And this isn't stuff that you're supposed to do, but this was the 2006 season before, you know, before they played Florida and lost by a gajillion points.
Yeah, things were going great at that time. So yeah,
exactly right. And I remember watching the Michigan game from like an airport bar because I was on my way home. And like, I still had my name tag on and everything. And we were just all looking around like, look, I'm not going to say anything if you're not, right? Like, okay, great. I wanted to see how this was going to end. That's part of the hustle. And I think we should respect it.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus ministered to people in bars. Why shouldn't you during the Ohio State game?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, right? There's commercials. There's timeouts. There's time to say, you know, other things.
To Richard's point real quick, and then I'll get off the Orlando kick, but I had a buddy who got married and his like wedding hotel for the guest was at Universal, and it was a Friday wedding. So the day after they were like, well, you can go to the parks if you want. And I was an Orlando local. So I just like took an Uber down and everyone just hung out at the old NASCAR cafe, which is now like the NBC Sports Bar and yes. Grill. And it was the best day ever. Cause you were like there with your friends and it was like, you were celebrating the wedding the next day, but really you were just watching college football all Saturday. And like, also felt like you weren't breaking the rules too much. Cause like you were there, but yeah, it was glorious.
I also want to point out very infrequently, but a big professional sports family. So any NFL game would trump literally any Christmas tradition whatsoever. If the 49ers were going to be tailgating and going to the game, whether that was Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And so that's a very interesting, like in hindsight, like, wow, like, I guess that's where the priorities are.
We never went to the games. I mean, we couldn't have afforded to if we wanted to, but football was always on, pro football was always on in our house on Christmas Day.
My first church was in northwestern Minnesota, and I think the first or second Christmas I was there was the first time that they had a Christmas Eve game, and it involved the Vikings. I don't remember who they were playing. I think they were playing the Packers, if I remember right. And I had a family show up to our, I think it was our 7 o'clock service or whatever, in their Vikings jersey with a TV, one of those little handheld Sony TVs. Cause this was even back before we had Wi-Fi really at a church. They literally watched it right up to the first. They at least did shut it off when we started the service. So I appreciated that. Or at least they turned the volume off. I didn't hear anything, but yeah, it was very clear where their priorities were that night.
I was going to just say they maybe did not turn it off, but just found a way to turn the volume off and mute it, because that happened. That's actually one of my first Christmas memories, is seeing somebody with a little handheld TV. And this is, mind you, like early 2000s, beyond the point that it was really a thing anymore. but I definitely remember a person or two carrying one of those still.
So I in high school became friends with someone whose father was a head coach in the NBA. It's a long story. I won't share who because this might go out.
Can you tell us the NBA, which division? Can you narrow it down at all?
Yeah, Eastern Conference. We'll go there, okay. And I'll keep the goodies in Discord. But the NBA obviously has done a whole big thing of like making Christmas Day like the, you know, five marquee games or whatever. And I learned from this coach that that was his least favorite thing in the entire world. Hmm. Because it like just disrupted the entire like family holiday tradition. They had to like be there early, and like literally hearing from this coach, like, please don't be a Christmas Day game. Please don't be a Christmas Day game this year.
Yeah, I always hate it for college football players who, sure, they get to go to Hawaii, but like they have to spend Christmas on a plane back from the Hawaii Bowl. Like, how stupid is that? We do not need that football game that badly, you know.
and a lot of those games that are like right around New Year's Day or maybe New Year's Eve, like they have to show up like either right at Christmas or sometimes even like right before. And it's just like, this is pathetic. Like, don't make them hang out in Tampa for this long. Just go a day later.
Yeah.
If every single one of those kids doesn't get a PlayStation 5 in their gift bag somehow, then this is not worth it at all.
It's important to note, Matt has been on a personal quest to acquire a PS5, so he's hoping to have as many in the marketplace as possible.
Yeah, I can confirm, even being in a tropical, exotic location alone on Christmas is not fun. So I can imagine for college football players or even NBA players, it's not the greatest thing in the world. Like, I used to work on cruise ships, right, and had to spend the Christmas.
Oh, that sounds horrible.
Okay, it actually wasn't too bad. So I worked on them until I met my wife and we started dating, and I cut that out. So, but the last trip I went on was an 11-day cruise with no kids on it, and I worked in the youth department. So I got through like 15 seasons of an NCAA dynasty. It was incredible.
I guess that's good if you can avoid everyone who is sad on a cruise ship at Christmas. But yeah, this was very fun. And I hope we get to do this again often. Thank you to everyone who does Patreon stuff. Thank you to our Discord friends, everyone who has ever helped out with the show, and to our three special guests. And Merry Christmas to all.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Thank you, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
And God bless us, everyone.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kirk.
Amen.
This was great.
Thank you. This is awesome.
See y'all in the Discord.
See y'all at Easter, right?
Roll Tide.
Get mad at PS5.
Once again, Merry Christmas to all. Thank you for listening. A reminder that all VBS revenues for the month of December 2020 will be going directly to Feeding America. That'll include Patreon stuff, our cut of our shirt deal at homefieldapparel.com. That's right, homefieldapparel.com. For the latest in youth group fashions. Thank you for joining us, and we will be back next time to finally finish the Book of Exodus.